Good evening and welcome to Little Atoms, with me, Padraig Reedy, and my co-host, Neil Denny. Little Atoms is a live talk show about ideas. The show is based around ideas of the Enlightenment and actively promotes science, freedom of expression, scepticism, and secular humanism. This means we often end up discussing the antithesis of these ideas. Things like superstition, religious fundamentalism, censorship, and conspiracy theory. Our guests bring ideas that are always challenging, sometimes controversial, often polemical, but always interesting. I'll hand over to Neil Denny to introduce this week's guest, Manjit Kumar.
Thanks, Padraig. Manjit Kumar has degrees in physics and philosophy. He was the founding editor of Prometheus, an interdisciplinary journal, described by one reviewer as perhaps the finest magazine that I've ever read. He is a co-author of Science and the Retreat from Reason, which introduced key areas of modern science while defending the Enlightenment notions of social progress and scientific advance against the loss of faith in progress and science. Manjit's latest book is Quantum, Einstein, Bohr and the Great Debate About Nature of Reality, which was shortlisted for the 2009 BBC Samuel Johnson Prize. And that's what we're going to be talking about tonight. Manjit, welcome to Little Atoms.
Pleasure.
Thank you for
here.
Joining us. So let's first of all talk about why you decided to write a book about quantum mechanics and, you know, the history of quantum theory.
Well, the book was really inspired by a photograph that I'd seen when I was growing up as a teenager. And in this photograph, which had been taken in 1927, there were 27 physicists gathered, and the photograph was taken in Brussels on what appeared to be like an overcast, wet, you know, Monday morning in October. And in this photograph, you had Einstein, who needs no introduction. You had Niels Bohr, the great Danish physicist who made fundamental contributions to understanding of the atom. Marie Curie. You had Heisenberg and Schrödinger, people I'd come across in while I was studying physics. And I just began to think, why are they all gathered there at one place at one time for this sort of wonderful team photograph? That was the initial inspiration for the book. And that led me to discover that every major player behind the discovery of the quantum and the development of quantum physics really was at this particular meeting. And I thought this was a great way to unfold the story of one of the great discoveries and the people who made those discoveries.
And that photograph, I think, is the fifth Solvay conference. That's the point we're going to get to, which is basically, as you said, is this anyone who's anyone in quantum physics. But let's go right back to the beginning, first of all, and we'll talk about where the very idea of the quantum came from. So let's talk about Max Planck and this idea of something that's called the black body problem. Now, perhaps you could tell us what that is.
Max Planck is one of these chaps in the photograph who sat on the front row. And the discovery of quantum is very much tied in with Max Planck. Max Planck discovered the quantum in 1900, between October and December. And he came up with the idea that energy was sliced and diced into packets. Previously, people had thought that energy, a bit like water from a tap, was continuous. It wasn't divided up into bits and pieces. Now, Planck decided that to understand blackbody radiation, which I'll explain in a second, he needed to slice and dice energy into packets so they could be exchanged in packets. A bit like going to a bank and only being able to exchange, you know, £1 coins, £5 notes, £10 notes, £20 notes. Now, Planck made the discovery that this is how energy was being exchanged in 1900. At that time, he was 42. He was a professor of physics at the University of Berlin, which was the leading scientific an academic institution in the German-speaking world. And the Germans had, for many years, been interested in producing more efficient light bulbs. Now, that might sound surprising that the discovery of quantum is tied up with something as practical as making better light bulbs. But Germany only came into being in 1870, 1871, following a war with the French. And so Germany was unified back then. And one of the things that this new German nation wanted to do was to become a real player, not only in Europe, but globally. Mm-hmm. And it wanted to challenge the Americans, and it wanted to challenge the British. And the sort of the thriving industry, the new technology of the day, was anything to do with electricity. It was the light bulb, it was generators and things like that. So the Germans had for a long time, you know, really devoted, you know, quite a lot of resources to harnessing science in the aid of German industry and technology. And what they had spent a lot of time in the 1890s doing, when the electron was discovered and radioactivity was being discovered, and scientists elsewhere had gone rushing off to their labs to replicate these experiments and, you know, and this new physics, some leading German scientists were trying to work out, actually, and understand a quite simple problem. And I've called it in the book the the problem of the hot iron poker. So we know, you know, we all know from experience, if you're shoving a hot iron poker into a fire, it will slowly start to heat up. And it, initially it's a dull red, then a bright red and orange. It goes through these various colours of the rainbow. And what German physicists wanted to understand was what was the relationship between the temperature of the poker, the colour of the light, and the intensity of the light that was being emitted. And they made this into what became known as the black body problem. I mean, physicists want to simplify everything. So even though the hot iron poker sounds like a quite simple problem, they even simplified it further. There's something that they could analyse and experiment on in the lab. And basically, a black body is really a high-tech oven, which you can heat to various temperatures. As you heat them, radiation begins to be emitted into the centre of the oven. And after a while, when the equilibrium is reached, you've got a distribution of the various different wavelengths of radiation in that oven. And what, in 1900, physicists, experimental physicists in Germany were doing, were devising ever more intricate experiments to measure ever more precisely the distribution of radiation within some of those cavities. And Max Planck, who was a real conservative, in fact, he looked very much like a Prussian civil servant. He came from a long line of lawyers and theologians and stuff, was the right man at the right place at the right time. And towards the end of 1900, he had access to the latest data, and he decided, as an act of desperation, that he was going to try and come up with a formula that could match the experimental distribution of radiation that the physicists were discovering in the experiment with a formula. And he just played around with the mathematics and the ideas that he'd accumulated over a 20-year career previously, and came up with a formula that fitted the experimental data that his colleagues had been collecting. Mm-hmm. What he ended up with was just a formula, and he knew that. So in October 1900, he had a formula that allowed him to map precisely the data and the curves that were being produced by his colleagues, but he didn't understand what it meant. He mm-hmm. didn't understand the underlying physics. So he then says that he spent the next 6 weeks undertaking the most strenuous work of his life, where he tried to invest this mathematical formula with physical meaning to try and understand what the equation was telling him. And the only way he could make the equation not fall apart as he tried to derive it was to assume that energy was sliced and diced. Mm-hmm. Initially, and for a long time after 1900, he thought it was simply a mathematical technique that
sure.
he inherited mm-hmm. from, you know, other people that had used the same thing, which you can slice and dice something mathematically, later you can make it vanish by a wave of the mathematician's.
But this is not something that he was thinking actually existed as a physical reality.
No, he didn't. He just mm-hmm. thought he was, you know, it was a mathematician's trick that he was employing mm-hmm. here to slice and dice energy. Because what he had to do was, if you imagine that there's energy in this high-tech oven, he's trying to slice and dice it so it gets distributed to reproduce the distribution of radiation, if you like, the energies, you know, of radiation in the thing. And he thought that actually this was just a mathematical trick and not physically real. He didn't think that radiation was sliced and diced into packets, mm-hmm. you know. And so in a sense, as I describe him in the book, I call him a reluctant revolutionary, mm-hmm. because even when he made the announcement to an august scientific gathering in December 1900, everybody applauded Planck for coming up with the solution to a long-standing problem, which the black body problem had become by 1900, and the fact that the Germans hopefully would have an edge now in the production of electrical light bulbs. Now, you might think, well, how does this fit with electrical light bulbs? Is that this equation that Planck had come up with is a worst-case scenario, mm-hmm. because what you want in a light bulb is as much light as possible and as little heat as
sure.
possible. And what the black body radiation formula that Planck had come up with, in a sense, with describing a black body, gives you, you know, as much heat as possible and as much light as possible at a certain temperature and stuff like that. So that was a benchmark that they could use to do further testing and make better light bulbs.
Well, what seems to be a theme right across the study of the quantum and quantum theory is this idea that a lot of the discoveries are made in this way. It's a fudge, it's a sort of contingent thing to make the maths work, that the scientists don't believe or don't want to believe that it's actually real. And then it does turn out to be so. And we'll see this time and time again. And the next example of that in this sort of time frame is Einstein comes along with an idea that he has basically his quantum theory of light. What you're talking about, the little packets in Max Planck's thing, is Planck. Is it Planck that gives them the name quanta?
Yes, Planck did. Yeah, and that comes from the Latin for packets or something, yeah?
Indeed. And so then Einstein comes along with this idea that you know, light itself, which we've always known before this as being light as a wave. Einstein comes up with this idea that light itself can be sort of quantized in the same way. And well, again, this is something that no one wants to accept.
Well, let me just contextualise this a little bit for you. I mean, in 1900, when Planck announced the quantum, you know, as I said, people applauded his achievement of coming up with a formula that predicted accurately the experimental data. Nobody took notice of the fact that he'd sliced and diced energy, right, and come up with the idea of the quantum, these packets of energy of that you couldn't slice any smaller. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, a £1 note was a £1 note, a £5 note was a £5 note, one couldn't become the other. No one really paid much attention to that. The one person who did was Albert Einstein. So when he read Planck's paper, he described it as if the rug had been pulled from underneath his feet, leaving no firm foundations on which he could build. Now, that's something quite remarkable for a chap who's like 22 at the time. You know, he's 22, he's not an academic, you know, he's struggling to find a job, and later on we know, most of your listeners will know, that he famously becomes a patent clerk in Switzerland. Mm-hmm. So he's away from the mainstream academia, so he's not influenced by anybody. He's working in the patent office in Bern. He reads Planck's paper. And over the next 3 or 4 or 5 years, he, you know, begins to develop his own ideas. And this is where his training as a patent clerk actually does benefit him, because he's being trained to look for weak points in an argument. I mean, that's what he does day in, day out as a professional patent examiner. And whereas Planck didn't want to believe, Einstein, and one of the things Planck didn't want to believe at the time, was that atoms existed. Because at the turn of the century, the 19th, 20th century, whether atoms existed or not was still a question that was up for debate. Even though the majority opinion atoms existed, there were still very influential and famous and distinguished physicists who doubted the existence of atoms, and Planck was one of them. And one of the things that he began to accept as he worked on the idea of the quantum was that atoms did exist. Now, Einstein was a real advocate of a belief in atoms already. Now, what Einstein was always really worried about was Planck's derivation, of how he got from his formula to the physical understanding and the quantum. So what Einstein did, which gives an insight into how, you know, what a genius he was in many ways, was that he derived Planck's equation for himself. And one of the ways he did that, the key to it, was that he imagined a box full of light, and he decided that he was going to model his box full of light on a box full of gas. Gas at the time was believed to be, a gas in a box was believed to be made up of atoms and molecules and stuff, so that if you heated the gas, the molecules went, you know, got that energy and bashed the wall slightly harder, and the pressure increased and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. So there were people who believed in what was known as the kinetic theory of gases. Einstein realized, what Einstein discovered was that if he put a gas, a light in a box and modeled it like a gas, he came up with Planck's formula. Mm-hmm. The difference between the two was, whereas Planck had, as a mathematical convenience, sliced and diced energy, Einstein believed that light was in fact made up of particles. Now, this was quite revolutionary, it was quite heretical at the time, because for a long time, for the best part of 100 years, it was believed that light was made up of waves. And so all of a sudden, Einstein, this chap who's a patent clerk in Bern, is submitting a paper in 1905... when he comes up with his quantum theory of light, when he submits it, which challenges prevailing orthodoxy. And the person he submits it to is a journal for which Planck is the advisor on theoretical physics. Hmm. Yeah, and he submits it in the same year, within a few months of submitting his famous paper on the special theory of relativity. Whereas Planck was very quick to acknowledge the special theory of relativity as a groundbreaking paper, he was rather reluctant about the... Einstein's paper on the quantum theory of light. But nevertheless, to his credit, he gave it the rubber stamp and it was published. Now, what Einstein did, once having coming up with the idea that light was made up of quanta, packets, and as they were later named, photons, he looked for a phenomenon that he could now use this idea to explain, and he explained famously the photoelectric effect.
You're listening to Little Atoms with Padraig Reedy, that's me, and Neil Denny, and our guest Manjit Kumar. Going into the second half of the show, Manjit, and let's flash forward from 1905 to 1927 and the conference that has inspired your book. So, I mean, briefly, who was there and what was at stake?
Right. We've already talked about two of the great pioneers of mm-hmm. the early history of quantum physics, which is Max Planck and Albert Einstein. The third was Niels Bohr. Mm-hmm. He was about 5, 6 or 7 years Einstein's junior. He's Danish. And in 1913, he comes up with the idea of the quantum atom. Mm-hmm. And I'm sure you know most people are familiar with the idea of the atom as a solar system mm-hmm. with the nucleus at the in the center with the electrons going around it. But back in 1913, that was a model of the atom that didn't work because electrons going around in a circle should spiral into the nucleus because they radiate energy. So this atom, which was called the Rutherford atom, should collapse. Bohr had come along and he'd made the magic wand and said, you know what? When electrons run certain orbits, they do not collapse, they do not spiral into the nucleus. So in a sense, even we talked about quantum as packets of energy, we could also start talking about quantization, the idea that other things also are, if you like, sliced and diced. There's no A to C going through B. Mm-hmm. So, for example, in the atom, electrons could be in certain orbits but not in others. Mm-hmm. That was Niels Bohr's great idea. And that they can jump. You know, this idea of the quantum jump between one orbit and another. And when they do that, they either absorb or emit energy. If they jump up, they absorb energy, and to jump down, they will radiate energy. So that was Niels Bohr, his great contribution for which he won the Nobel Prize. In 1927, there's the Fifth Solvay Conference, as Neil said, in October, and at that conference, you have Bohr, Einstein, Planck, the sort of the early pioneers of the quantum. But you also have the next generation. You have Erwin Schrödinger, who's an Austrian physicist, slightly older than some of the other people who are attending. You have Werner Heisenberg, who's the German wunderkind. Mm-hmm. You know, we've all heard of the Heisenberg uncertainty principle, and that's him. We have Wolfgang Pauli from Pauli's exclusion principle mm-hmm. about how electrons occupy atoms and stuff like that. So they're all gathered there. And what they're gathered there for is to try and make sense of quantum physics, because there's one thing, as we discovered with Planck, of getting the mathematics and having a theory, in which by 1927 they had a theory. They had two, you know, wave mechanics by Schrödinger, matrix mechanics by Heisenberg, which were shown to be equivalent. So we have a theory, quantum mechanics. The problem now is, what does it say about the nature of reality? In September 1927, Niels Bohr had given a lecture in Italy at a conference, and anybody who was anybody was there to hear him for the first time articulate what became known as the Copenhagen Interpretation. This was known as Copenhagen Interpretation because Bohr was the head of an institute in Copenhagen, and the leading light of this interpretation of what quantum physics was saying about the nature of reality were Niels Bohr, Werner Heisenberg, and Wolfgang Pauli, and Max Born, somebody who was a bit older than the other three. In mm-hmm. fact, Heisenberg and Pauli had been Max Born's assistants in Germany as they were in the early days of their career. One of the people who wasn't there in Italy was Albert Einstein, mm-hmm. who at that point was world famous because of general relativity. He wouldn't set foot in fascist Italy. Now, when Bohr goes to Brussels in 1927, the one person he wants to convince of the correctness of the Copenhagen interpretation is Albert Einstein. And so for Bohr, he shows up in Copenhagen to convince Einstein. Einstein shows up in Brussels at the Fifth Solvay Conference to begin a dialogue and discussion and debate to try and pick holes in the Copenhagen interpretation.
Very briefly, what is the Copenhagen interpretation? What distinguishes it from the other, where I think was Schrödinger's interpretation of quantum mechanics? What is it that makes it different?
Well, the best way of looking at it is by looking at the two main protagonists in the book. Mm-hmm. You have Albert Einstein on the one side, and you have Niels Bohr and his colleagues, like, as I mentioned, Heisenberg and Pauli and Born on the other side. What distinguishes the two of them? What are the positions they're taking? Einstein believes that there's a world out there that exists independently of him. So the moon exists when he's not looking at it. Mm-hmm. He famously asked someone later in life, you know, do you believe that the moon exists when you're not looking at it? For Einstein, the moon existed if he didn't look at it. And the world exists independently of him or human beings. And it was the job of the scientist to understand that. And on that basis, he wanted to evaluate quantum mechanics, one of the great theories that physicists have come up with. And Einstein found it to be wanting. He thought, look, it's a great theory, but there are limitations, and we should be looking for new concepts, new ideas. We should be going beyond this stuff. That should be our search, mm-hmm. our quest, if you like. Bohr and his colleagues believe that, in fact, yes, quantum mechanics is a great theory. And what they try to do, which is something quite interesting, which was that they try to develop a worldview, a view of what nature was like on the basis of trying to understand quantum mechanics. Mm-hmm. So for Einstein, he adopted a philosophical position that the world exists independently of him, and using that, he evaluated quantum mechanics. Bohr and Heisenberg, what they decide, really, is that this is quantum mechanics, what does it tell us about the world? Mm-hmm. And the world that they believed the quantum mechanics had revealed to them was one in which an electron doesn't have a position until you do an experiment to measure its position. An electron doesn't have a velocity until you do an experiment to measure its velocity. In a sense, an act of observation brings about an aspect of reality. For Einstein, this was a little bit too much, right? You know, Einstein thought, no, an electron, you might not know its position or its velocity or what have you, but if you've got an electron in a box, there's an electron in a box, and, you know, we do an experiment and we can find out all sorts of things about it. Heisenberg and Bohr would say, well, is there an electron in the box? Yeah, we don't know anything until we do an actual experiment. And Schrödinger's famous cat, mm-hmm. where instead of an electron, Schrödinger comes up with this idea in 1935 that I have a cat in a box, and in this box there's a vial of poison and a means by which this vial will be cracked. And he asks the question, well, is the cat dead or alive? Now, Einstein and Schrödinger would say, the cat's either dead or it's either alive, and we can work it out when we open it up and have a look mm-hmm. inside. Heisenberg and Bohr and the Copenhagen interpretation would say, well, it's not either the cat's alive or dead, but the cat can be dead, alive, and everything in between at the same time, yeah, until you do an act of observation, which is open the box and then see yeah. which of it is. It can actually be in the superposition of states. Now, Heisenberg and Bohr generally believe that. Schrödinger and Einstein, you know, believed that the cat was either dead or alive. Mm-hmm. And Schrödinger tried to show up the absurdity of the Copenhagen sort of position. So 1927 is really the first round of the Einstein-Bohr debate, when, not during the formal conference proceedings, but in the breakfast session, you know, breakfast mm-hmm. in the morning or later in the evening, Einstein would try to come up with a thought experiment to challenge the Copenhagen interpretation. Bohr would scratch his head, consult with his colleagues, and try to find a counter-argument. And they knocked it backwards and forwards. And once you look at that photograph from 1927, there's a little bit of a smirk on Bohr's face there, thinking that during the course of the week, he'd managed to bat away all Einstein's objections, which he had done successfully, and to the delight of his colleagues. So that was round one, and it went to Bohr.
We're talking here about the... There's always this idea that once we're in the quantum level, basically all bets are off. Normal physics doesn't apply and things like that. So it may seem like a facile point, but, Bohr and Heisenberg weren't arguing that the moon isn't there when I'm not looking at it, are they? This idea that as observers we can have an influence on something and that effect can, you know, anything can happen, you know, all the probabilities can happen at whatever, and we can have an effect on it when we look at it. But they're talking about that particularly, this is at the quantum level, not extrapolated into real life.
Well, you're absolutely right. I mean, Schrödinger brings a cat into the box, mm-hmm. not an electron into the box, to try and sort of magnify up mm-hmm. some of these problems to get a handle onto these. Yeah. Einstein, you know, I mean, there is a philosophical discussion, mm-hmm. and that's a topic for another show, about whether the moon exists, whether you look mm-hmm. at it or not. Or, you know, the classic one, you know, if no one's around to hear it, there's a tree that's being felled in a forest make a noise. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So they're not really arguing about that. They know that the quantum world is completely weird world, you know, it's completely different from the classical world that we inhabit. The world we inhabit, a world, and it's the world of Newton and classical physics, you know, the sort of physics from Galileo and Newton and Kepler and stuff, all the way up to through the 19th century. What they're really debating about is what is the nature of reality deep mm-hmm. down, yeah, and also the nature of science and the role of science and the direction of physics, because Einstein genuinely believes that there's a world out there at the atomic level. Mm-hmm. That exists independently of him. Bohr believes that there's a world out there, and then this quantum world is a phenomenal sort of world. Yeah, it doesn't exist in the absence of act of observation or an experiment. So there is no electron for Bohr unless you do an experiment mm-hmm. to discover its position or its momentum or its velocity. For Einstein, there is, even if you don't know it. You know, for Bohr, that's a meaningless question, a meaningless sort of idea, you know, that there's an electron there. But he's saying, well, you know, nothing's there until we do some measurements.
Really briefly, because we're very quickly running out of time, bearing in mind that the Copenhagen interpretation is the the interpretation that has become the dominant interpretation of quantum mechanics, how then do we extrapolate that to this idea that quantum mechanics is the most successful scientific theory of all time and the modern world wouldn't exist without...
Well, there's two questions there. There's two points I'd like to make there. One, first of all, that you're right, that for 60 years, from 1920, from the mid-20s onwards, for 60 years into the mid-80s, into the early 90s, the Copenhagen interpretation was the most dominant one. In the last two decades, that's changed. As with the advent of new areas of physics like quantum cosmology, people have begun to question the Copenhagen interpretation. And Murray Gell-Mann, a Nobel Prize-winning American physicist, famously said that Niels Bohr brainwashed generations of physicists into believing the job of understanding quantum mechanics had been done. So I think that there are cracks in the Copenhagen interpretation, and it's not as black and white as it once was. And secondly, you're asking a question about the relevance, I suppose. Of quantum physics. Well, quantum physics, it does make when the war go round. Mm-hmm. Quantum physics is at the heart of, electronics and all the things that electronics powers. We're sitting in the studio, and most of the studio is made possible by the use of quantum physics. There's one thing about, using the mathematics, and churning out the answers and the appliance of science. There's another question, which is about trying to understand what it's telling us about the nature of reality. And that's what lies at the heart of the Einstein-Bohr debate, which I discuss in my book.
Which is, just to finish off with, Quantum, Einstein-Bohr and the Great Debate About Reality. And it's from Icon Books. Manjit, thank you very much for coming in and talking to us. We could have talked all night about this subject, I think.
Pleasure.